Please note that this only refers to when people are playing about with hypnotism or trances, and there is no danger whatever in the awake, asleep and asleep. Awake of ordinary day and night living. It follows from all this that you would not be very wise to meddle with trance states unless you are carefully supervised, doesn't it? In certain temples the person being trained is supervised by two senior lamas who are able to keep contact with whatever the acolyte is thinking, and by their gentle but firm guidance, 158, the acolyte is prevented from doing any harm to himself or having caused any harm to anyone else. When the acolyte can pass certain tests, then he is permitted to go into deep trances by himself, and usually one of the first things he will do is to go into a very deep trance, what we term the trance of vision. This is a deep trance indeed, and the initiate will be completely immobile. He might appear to be utterly rigid, even with hard flesh. In this particular state he is still within his body, but is very much like a man on top of a high tower who has a high-powered telescope which enables him to see very clearly and greatly magnified. The man with the telescope can turn in any direction, and can see what is going on with startling clarity. One does not get out of the body in the trance of vision, instead you have to wait and practice the trance of projection before you can get out, and in this case the body is limp and flaccid, and is in a cataleptic condition with all consciousness being withdrawn and the body remaining, as it were, under the supervision of the caretaker. Breathing goes on at a very much reduced rate, and the heartbeat is reduced and life just flows very leisurely indeed. First of all, when you get in these trances you will wonder if what you are seeing is imagination, but with practice you will know that which is real and will easily detect that which is merely a thought projection from some other entity, whether incarnate or discarnate. To give you an illustration, you are somewhere, anywhere you like, sitting at peace and doing deep trance meditation. If you let your consciousness wander willy-nilly without having much control of it, you might find yourself near a person who has had too much to drink, and you may be horrified to see all manner of queer animals wriggling around him. Yes, those striped elephants really do exist in thought form. Worse than that, though, supposing you allow yourself to just wander and you find yourself near a very, very bad-tempered man with murder in his heart. If he is thinking of murder, then you poor sufferer, will see the actual scenes as if they were reality instead of just thought, and you may come back to your body with such a jerk that you will get a headache for the next 24 hours thinking that you have witnessed a murder or worse. The initiated metaphysician can easily recognize that which, 159, is real and that which is imaginary, but it is again advised that unless you have some real reason for deep trance, you leave it alone. If you will not heed that advice, well heed this: if in a deep trance or in the astral you find horrible entities making faces at you or worse, then you merely have to think strong thoughts at them that you are not afraid, and if you do that you will find that these people disappear. They can only feed on fear, and if you are not afraid they are actually repelled. In sincere friendship I advise you not to allow yourself to be hypnotized except by a competent medical person, and I advise you not to undergo trance except under qualified supervision. The ordinary meditation is perfectly safe, no harm at all can come to you because you are in full possession of all your faculties. So, meditate and enjoy it immensely. Avoid hypnotism and deep trance because they will not further your development one iota. 160. Chapter 9. Is astral travel for you? The dark mists of night gradually turned grey and slowly retreated from the rising sun. For some time dank tendrils of fog rose up from the long grass. Soon one could discern the old world village of Much Nattering nestling deep in the valley formed by the Cotswold Hills. A forest spread down the slopes as if threatening to engulf the little village. Through the center of the main street a small brooklet twinkled and tinkled along, carrying with it all the refuse of an older civilization. Much Nattering was a typical English village with small stone houses thatched with yellow rushes from the nearby marshes. At the far end of the village was the village green, in the center of it the ducking pool where the scolds were dipped in the chair at the end of a long beam projecting far out over the stagnant, slime-covered water. Nearer the village side of the pond, was a small stone platform, probably the remains of an old basalt eruption from the mountainside. Here it was the custom to take witches and throw them in the water to see if they sank or swam. If they sank and drowned, they were innocent. If they swam, then it was adjudged that the devil was supporting them, and so the poor wretch would be thrown back again until eventually the devil's arm got tired and she drowned. The maypole was still decked with its ribbons, for yesterday had been a holy day and the youth of the village had been dancing the maypole and plighting their troth. As the light increased and the day advanced, small trickles of smoke seeped up from holes in mud roofs, or from small chimneys in thatched roofs, signs that the yeomen of England had bestirred themselves to get their breakfasts before setting out for their work. Breakfast ale to drink and dry rough bread to eat, for in those days there was no such thing as tea or coffee, no cocoa, and rarely, perhaps once a year, did they eat meat of any kind. Only the richer families knew the taste of any meat, the rest, that which they could produce in their own locality. 161. There came the sounds of much bustle, the sounds of much movement. Soon men were pouring out of doors, going to shippens or barns, or going out into the fields to catch and harness horses. The womenfolk were busy inside their houses, clearing up, dusting, making, and mending, and wondering how to make do with the small amount of money available, for so much was done by barter, and now everyone in the village knew what everyone else had, and it was time for some of the travelling men to come and bring new items. The morning wore on, shining bright shafts of sunlight along the village street reflecting brightly from the greenish bull's eye glass in some of the windows. Soon there came a great commotion. Mistress Helen Highwater pounced out of a house at the end of a street and pounded down the cobbled way, her old elastic-sided boots peeping shyly from beneath her voluminous skirts as they swirled slightly with the speed of her passing. Beneath the beribboned poke bonnet which she wore, her face shone bright red and was covered with a thin film of perspiration. On she swept like a full-rigged schooner racing before a winter gale. Clack clack, clack clack, clack clack. Tapped her heels on the tops of the smooth cobbles. Every so often she turned her head without stopping her headlong flight, turned to peer over her shoulder as if she thought she might be pursued by the devil. Just a glance, then on she went with renewed vigor, her breath coming in short puffs and pants. Soon, by the time she reached the end of the street, her breath was coming in a series of staccato grunts. At the end of the cobbled street she turned right to where the apothecary's shop stood in solitary splendor just apart from the rest of the houses. For a moment she paused in her headlong flight and looked about her once again, then she looked up at the leaded windows above her. Peering around the side of the house she saw that the apothecary's horse was not tethered, so returning to the front again she dashed up the three worn stone steps and pushed open the solid oaken door. Clang clang. Clang clang went a little bell as she pushed her way into a dark and gloomy room. Odors assailed her from every quarter, musk and cinnamon, lemon, sandalwood, and pine, and other strange scents which her nostrils could not identify. She stood there panting and puffing and trying to get back her breath, when from a 162-163 room behind the shop appeared another woman, the apothecary's wife. "Oh, Ida Shakes," said Helen Highwater. "I saw it again last night. There she was up in the sky with the moon as her background. She was naked, naked as a jaybird and riding on a big birch broom." She shuddered and looked as if she was about to faint, so Ida Shakes hurried forward and guided her to a chair by the side of the little counter. "There, there," she cried, "just you get yourself set down and tell me all about it. I will pour up a measure of ale and then you will feel better." Helen Highwater sighed dramatically and allowed her eyes to roll heavenwards. "There I was," she said, "standing in my shift before the bedroom window looking out upon God's glory of the moon and the night sky." She paused and sighed again. "Suddenly," she continued, "I looked towards the right and a big old owl flew across the window, and as he flew across I saw that he was fleeing from something. I craned my neck to the right, and there she was soaring across the sky, with not a bit of a shift upon her, and I thought, oh dear me, all those men who were out benights and the gypsies down by the covert, whatever would they think to see a Satan's daughter sailing overhead so? Ida Shakes poured out more ale, and they drank together in silence for a while. Then the apothecary's wife said, "Let us go together and tell this tale to our priest, the Reverend Mr. Dogged. He will know what to do with it. Now you just get your breath back while I get my bonnet on and we will be out together. I will have the apprentice look after the shop." With that she turned on her heel and hurried into the back room where Helen Highwater heard her giving orders in a short, sharp tone of voice. Soon the two ladies, chattering away like magpies, were hurrying down the side road towards the parsonage, and towards a conference with the worthy pastor and keeper of their souls, the Reverend Mr. Dogged. Miles away in a small village far from London, the fierce Cardinal Wolsey turned restlessly on his bed. He was making his plans to hunt witches, making his plans to make and unmake kings and bring austerity to princes as well as to paupers. He had retired to his country mansion at the village of Hampton, some miles from London town. Even then he was planning to rebuild the mansion and make it into a veritable court to rival one that of a king in London. But now the cardinal, who little knew that in future years his name would be a trademark for underwear, tossed restlessly, while throughout the length and breadth of England his special investigators prowled, watchful, hoping to be led to witches that they could be tortured and burned at the stake to the glory of God and to save their souls. The worthy cardinal pondered upon all these things, and he leaned back upon his soft cushions and thought with smug complacency how he would reorganize heaven when he eventually got there, although he had no plans to leave the earth at the moment as he was enjoying much power. Back in the village of Much Nattering, the two ladies stood up to take leave of the Reverend Mr. Dogged. "Well, then ladies," he said somberly, "we will keep watch on that widow of whom you spoke, and we will see what we shall see, and having seen we shall act to the glory of God." He nodded gravely and ushered Ida Shakes and Helen Highwater out of the parsonage door. For the rest of the day little groups of women could be seen furtively whispering to each other, and peering up towards the forest which loomed at the perimeter of the village. There was much nodding of heads and shaking of heads, much folding of hands beneath aprons. The men, ignorant of what was going on, looked mystified at the strange doings of their womenfolk, as men always do anyhow, and just put it down to a form of moon madness which came upon women every so often. Down by the maypole a small group of boys and girls twirled and twisted and pranced around as they practiced the steps for a new maypole dance which they were shortly going to perform before visitors from another village. Soon the shadows of night gathered, and back from the darkening fields came the men who had labored long throughout the day. Drooping with weariness they trudged along the cobbled streets and lurched into their homes. In the shadow of the parsonage four men waited silently, leaning up against the wall, talking in the lowest of low whispers. Then as the darkness became more profound a figure appeared from the side door of the parsonage. It was the Reverend Mr. Dogged himself. The four men respectfully touched a forelock to the parson. He said, "Follow me to the widow's cottage. I, 165, have sent a messenger to fetch the interrogators." So saying, he turned and strode off circumnavigating the main part of the village and heading towards the forest. For some 20 minutes they walked, and then they entered the dark shadows cast by the pine trees. Here progress was quite difficult. Here there was only the purple loom from the night sky which filtered down through bare branches, but through familiarity they could feel and detect their way, so they pressed on, trying to be as silent as they could. At last they approached a clearing and passed by a pile of hazel twigs and some remnants of charcoal. Passing that they turned to the left and saw the dark outline of a rough hut ahead of them. Now their caution was extreme, they moved carefully with complete circumspection. Softly they tiptoed across the clearing to the hut. In single file they approached the window which was roughly curtained, but the merest chink of light shone out. The priest moved forward and put an eye to the chink, and looked inside. Inside he saw a sparse room, roughly furnished with homemade furniture cut from the trees themselves. The light he saw was the light from a burning pine knot on which the resin still dripped down. As it fled and sputtered, he could see that in the center of the room was an old woman sitting on the floor. By carefully listening he could detect that she was mumbling something, but some moments he stood there watching and listening. Then out of the darkness swooped a bat. It dived down and clutched the hair of one of the men. With a shriek of terror, he leapt to his feet and then fell flat on his face, petrified with fright. As the priest and the three other men looked in stupefied astonishment, the door of the hut creaked open, and in it stood the old woman. The priest was galvanized into life. Dramatic ally pointing a forefinger at her, he shouted, "Daughter of Satan, we have come for you." The old woman, struck with terror, and well knowing the fate in store for her, fell to her knees wailing. At a sign from the priest, the three other men, now slowly followed by the fourth who sheepishly climbed to his feet, went to the old woman, two held her arms roughly behind her and two entered the hut. They rummaged around, and not finding any spells or signs of magical instruments, they overturned the pine knot into a pile of pine needles so that the hut flared, and as the men retreated, burned to the ground. In the basement of the church the old woman knelt before, 166, the priest. "I have sent for the interrogators," he thundered. "You are a daughter of Satan, you have sailed across the sky naked in company with Satan." The poor old woman shrieked with terror, knowing that as her house had been burned, judgment had been passed upon her without any trial. "You are going to be kept in a cell for the night to await the pleasure of His Majesty's investigators," said the priest, and turning to the four men he instructed them to take the old woman to the local prison and keep her locked up until the next morning. Late the next morning there was the thunder of hooves along the hard-packed earth road, ending in a clatter as the horsemen joined the cobbled main street and reined in at the parsonage. From the leading horse descended His Majesty's interrogator of witches, a surly, bloated-faced man with narrow-pig-like eyes. He was followed by his assistant and two torturers who lovingly removed the bags containing their instruments of trade from the horses' backs. Together they went into the parsonage where the priest was expecting them. For some time there was animated discussion, and then the men left the parsonage and made their way to the room which was used as the local jail. Entering they seized the old woman, who was now gibbering with terror, and stripped her of her clothing. Examining her minutely, inch by inch from head to foot, they jabbed sharp pins into her to see if there was any spot which was immune to pain, one of the standard tests for witches. Soon also they put thumb screws upon her and tightened them until she screamed and the screws ran red. Still having no confession from her, for in truth she had nothing to confess, they seized her by her hair and dragged her out at a run all the way down the cobbled village street to the ducking pond, where by now a crowd of avid, eager spectators had collected in the hope and knowledge of seeing a witch drowned. The old woman was held upright naked on the stone platform while men went to each side of the pond. Then the priest stood in front of her and said, "In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, I urge you now to make your true confession that according to God's mercy you may die knowing that your soul be saved. Confess ere it be too late." With that he made the sign of the cross in the air and stood aside. 167, the old woman was speechless with terror. Four men grabbed her by her arms and legs, and swung her high into the air. Up she went, and turned a somersault in the air before falling headfirst into the scummy, stagnant pond. For moments there were just ripples on the surface, and then her streaming hair and head appeared. She threshed wildly at the water and seemed to make some headway at swimming. Then some spectator threw a heavy rock which caught her on the side of the head. Other rocks followed. The poor old woman gave a horrid, soul-wrenching scream, and an eyeball was seen dangling down her cheek. Further rocks dislodged it and the body stained red. For a minute, perhaps more, there seemed to be turmoil beneath the water and a whole fountain of red, blood-stained water spurted up in a little mound. One of the investigators turned to another and said, "So, Satan did not save her, perhaps, as she claimed, she was innocent after all." The man to whom he spoke shrugged and turned aside as he said, "Oh well, what's it matter? We've all got to die sometime, we put her out of her misery." Unnoticed, isolated, and alone, an aged hunchback lurked in the shade of a little clump of trees. From his eyes tears slowly oozed and coursed down his seamed and wizened cheeks. From time to time he attempted to wipe them away with the back of an gnarled hand. Intently he peered forth from beneath white, shaggy eyebrows. Spasmodically his left hand gripped and re-gripped the twisted old stick which he used to assist him in his painful movements of walking. As the poor old woman sank beneath the water surface for the last time, to become in her death agony entangled in the clinging weeds below, he muttered, "Sad, sad." A woman hurrying along the path to try to see something before it was all over, spied the twisted old man and stopped beside him. "What happened to her, Grandpa?" she asked in a shrill voice. "Murdered," replied the hunchback in surly tones. "Murdered on the altar of ignorance and superstition. She was no witch. I went to school with her, a pure soul who had no evil in her." The young woman glowered and said menacingly, "You'd better be careful what you're saying, Grandpa, or you'll find, 168, yourself in that pond with her. There's been some ugly rumors about you, you know. If I wasn't a good granddaughter I'd tell on you myself." So saying she hurried off to peer with avid fascination at the surface of the now still pond, a surface ruffled only occasionally by a bursting bubble plopping to the surface. The hunchback stared towards her with brooding eyes, and then muttered to himself, "Superstition, superstition, always the enemy of progress. We who do astral travel are the prey of the wicked, the ignorant, and the jealous, those who cannot do it themselves and who give the wrong thoughts to we who can. I must be careful, I must be careful." Sadly he looked again towards the pond, for now investigators had brought the old woman's clothing, which they dumped upon the stone where she had stood. Solemnly, with many a religious incantation, they applied flint and tinder to the torn old rags. Fanning the first sparks into flame they had the clothing blazing, and small particles of black and burnt material swept upwards on vagrant wind. The old hunchback turned away sadly, shrugged his shoulders, and stumbled blindly into the sheltering woods. Yes, throughout the centuries those who could do astral travel have been persecuted and penalized by the jealous ones who cannot do astral travel, and who resent the thought that others can do what they cannot. Yet almost anyone can astral travel if their motives are right, if their thoughts are pure, and if they practice. Let us see what it takes to do astral travel. In the first place, one must have absolutely pure thoughts, because when one can travel in the astral it is a simple matter indeed to go to a person's house and see them, no matter where they are in that house, no matter what they are doing. It is possible to look over the shoulder of a person who is writing a letter, and read the letter. It is possible. But wrong, criminally wrong. The genuine person doing astral travel would never think of so intruding upon the privacy of another, and if one did intrude by accident, then one would never, never talk of what one had seen. So, unless you are sure, completely sure beyond the slightest shadow of a doubt that you do not want to intrude upon the privacy of another, then you will find that it is very difficult indeed to get into the astral consciously. Almost everyone gets into the astral subconsciously, that is, when one is asleep, but consciously, that is a different matter. 169. I get a vast number of letters asking me to visit such and such a person by astral travel to say what is wrong with him or her. But even if I was prepared to do this, there are still only 24 hours in the day, and it would be an utter impossibility to go to all the places because of the time consumed. In any case, it is morally wrong to rush along to someone's house and peer at them in the bedroom or elsewhere. Too often people want an astral visit because they are too lazy to take the necessary steps to cure themselves, or just for idle curiosity. Another bar to astral travel in the awake state is imposed on people who want to astral travel so that they can talk about it and show how clever they are. If you do conscious astral travel, you never talk about it, because it is a very great privilege to be able to do it, and one only talks about it when one is trying to help others. So if you think that astral travel will take the place of a guided tour or provide more entertainment than your television, that would be easy! Think no more about astral travel, for if you think thus it is not for you. A third bar is imposed upon those who want to astral travel so that they may control the affairs of others. There are many people who are do-gooders, They want to rush around the world in the astral, putting things right without knowing why things are presumably wrong. It is very wrong indeed to force a person to have help. After all, the person concerned knows his own affairs best, so if someone bumbles along in the astral and tries to peer and pry and then tells the victim that this, that, or something else should be done, that is taking an unwarranted liberty. You may wonder what can be done by astral travel if there are so many limitations. Well, alright, this is what can be done. You can visit any of the great libraries throughout the world, you can visit any part of the world, you can learn from ancient manuscripts, you can, yes, this is quite true, visit other worlds when you advance sufficiently. But if you want to travel and you succeed in astral traveling, and then you give way to temptation and you just peer at someone in the privacy of their own home, then you are doing wrong and possibly you may not astral travel again. One of my interests is to watch people going off at night. I like to sit by a window, preferably from a high vantage point, and watch over a sleeping city. Shall I tell you what I is like? Shall I tell you how I see things? 170 Night has fallen and above us the ageless stars twinkle silvery, or blue, or red light. The air is clear and calm, street lights shed some slight radiance into the sky and make it appear that there are dancing motes bubbling above the streets. From the rooftops of the city comes the bluish-white haze as if an impalpable mist is rising. The mist rises perhaps 30 feet, perhaps 100 feet, becoming bluer and bluer. Then the surface of the mist bubbles like the bubbles on a pot of boiling tar. The bubbles burst and gleaming streamers of pale blue-white light emerge and streak up into the night sky. The threads of light become thinner and thinner, but they are always there. They radiate in all directions, to the north, to the south, to the west, and to the east. Some go straight up into the infinity above, and yet curiously enough some go straight down as if searching for another form of life in the core of this earth of ours. The bodies of the people of this city are asleep, but their astral bodies are traveling, as proof whereof their silver cords are agleam in the darkness of the night. They stretch up, and ever and anon a little thrill or ripple comes racing along the silver cord, and there is a jerk and a twitch and the cords contracts, and soon the astral body comes down, disappears into the blue mists and afterwards goes into the body again. These are people who have been disturbed by perhaps the opening of a door or the tossing of a partner. These are the people who awaken in the morning with a headache and memories of a horrid nightmare. Just about everyone does astral travel, but unfortunately because of the teachings of the West most forget what they have learned and what they have done when they return to the body, and if an astral is reeled in suddenly it gives rise to nightmares and a complete shattering of all memories of the actual experience. Most people have had the experience of a violent jerk as they were falling asleep. Most people have had an experience of a rising and falling, and a sensation that they were falling out of a tree or off a cliff. That was verging upon remembering astral travel, but again, remember that astral travel is a thing which almost anyone can do consciously if one remembers the provisos previously mentioned in this chapter. Some distance away within my line of sight there was a great building, a prison. Around the walls the lights burn throughout the night and occasionally a bright spotlight would, 171, flicker along the walls, but at this time of the night most of the cells were dark, yet not dark because the lights of the silver cord go up. The imprisoned men escape by night into the astral, for truly it is said that iron bars do not a prison make, iron bars restrain the flesh, but they are no bar to the astral. Thus it is that those are judged guilty, and the innocent alike, mingle and go up about their separate travels in the night. All too frequently from the penthouses atop the high buildings one gets terrible sordid thoughts, and even the silver cords which protrude from such places are often duller and tainted. For those who pander to the lusts of the flesh do not travel to the highest planes, instead they are confined to the lower astral where they meet depraved and unevolved personalities to match their own. Supposing you have gone through all this, and you have decided that you have no lusts, no desire to peer at others in the privacy of their own homes, suppose you decide that you are one who can travel consciously, well, this is how you should go about it. Make a definite experiment, Make an arrangement with some very close friend that you will, with his or her permission, visit the house that night. Have your friend agree to put something, perhaps some written message on her table so that you can read the message put there for you and repeat it back the next day to test your progress. When you go to bed, make sure that it is at a reasonable hour, that is, fairly early.